and welcome to episode 38 of this little podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and I'm joined by the very thoughtful co-host, David Grigg. Hello, David.
How are you, Perry? I'm pretty good, thoughtful perhaps, maybe that's the right term. We're all sitting here being thoughtful about our circumstances and keeping our fingers crossed about things changing, but we're not quite there yet.
Oh, well, see, I take you as more the thoughtful one, David. I've noticed that there was a little comment that an old friend of ours, Lee Edmonds, made about how he liked the podcast. He liked the fact we didn't get too emotional about things, except he said, well, Perry does occasionally. So I'm the one that gets emotional about these books and things. And you're more the calmer influence, David. I look at it being the thoughtful one that basically takes their time and looks at things properly, and I just go, yeah, no. That's pretty much the way that I look at it. As I've said, I have an emotional response to books, and then I try and figure out why, so I don't break them down maybe the same way that you did, but that's okay because you can look at your reading any way you like.
Absolutely, absolutely. I like Lee's comment. I think he says something like, you know, they talk sensibly about books mostly. In practice, mostly.
Now, is that mostly about the books, or is it mostly about the sensible talking?
Yeah, mostly sensible. I can't remember his exact quote, but there was a bracketed thing there. Maybe not.
Yeah, well, he did say also earlier on that he liked the fact that there was discussion of books, but in a sort of light-hearted way. We don't sort of.
Oh, that's true. We're not academics.
No, we're not academics. We're not here to write PhD theses. All we're trying to do is review them from a reader's perspective and try to put in our experience of reading science fiction or crime or fantasy or horror or literary fiction, whatever it is that we read. And we're trying to put that across and say what we like and say what we don't like. And I think that's the major thing. I read a lot of book reviews, and sometimes I come out at the end of it and I think, did this guy like this book or not? I got no idea. And surely that's what I want to know. I mean, if you don't like it, you don't have to actually say this is a lot of crap, but you can actually say this wasn't for me or something along the lines to give the reader an indication as to should I spend my money on it. Remember the old line was, you have to try and convince people to spend their beer money on your books.
Yeah.
Whoever that was, it might have been Heinlein who said that, or Campbell, one of those back in the 50s, that the major reason being, you've got a certain amount of time and money to spend on those entertainments. And there's a lot of call on our money. And for you and I, David, now that we're retired and we don't have as much, we have to be very careful about where we spend our money on the entertainment. And so we do like to get to the point where we attempt to tell people whether we think a book is worth their while. And hopefully we do that.
Indeed, indeed.
So we won't talk about the pandemic anymore, David. I think we've said enough of that over the last 3 or 4 months, and we're still in it, but we're still going, we're still still surviving, still staying here, still reading.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. All right, I had a little quick fix-up from the last episode. I was talking about the play R.U.R. by a Czech writer, and I've discovered with the benefit of Wikipedia that his name should be pronounced Karel Čapek. The little duver over the sea means it's a soft C, not a hard C. So Karel Čapek.
Karel Čapek. Thank you for that. As mentioned at the end of last episode, David, this time we're going to be talking about megastructures in science fiction. Now, these are sometimes known as big, dumb objects, which is almost what we called this episode, but then we thought, better not. That was an irreverent term coined by the British critic Roz Kaveny in the 1980s, when she wrote a critic of science fiction in the 1970s. In particular, she was thinking about Larry Niven's Ringworld, which a lot of people will know, and which we'll get to a little bit later, but also about those other big objects in space which turned out to be not really so dumb, after all, a lot of them being inhabited by high-functioning artificial intelligences. So that's why we're not talking about big, dumb objects, really, because they're not necessarily always dumb. Some of them are quite intelligent, but so we're just going to stay with the term megastructures. I think that's probably about the best. Now, we've discussed this episode, David, amongst ourselves, and our aim here is not to provide an overall comprehensive catalogue of megastructures in science fiction, but merely to introduce the subject and to discuss a few examples of the theme that we've come across or which we've read or which we think people might have missed, basically, because there's a lot of them around that people will have heard of. But really, we need a definition first up, I think, more than anything else, so we know what it is we're talking about. So the definition I've got here is that a megastructure is a vast and enigmatic structure in space or on a planet. Can be anywhere. As a rule, they will have been constructed by some mysterious race of beings, by far future humans who have become very technologically advanced, or by some other alien race that we know nothing about. Now, the structure may also be naturally occurring through some as yet undetermined process. So the method of construction is not really the important issue here. It's merely the size of the thing, how big it is. Now, some of the structures that fall within the boundaries of this definition may appear to be small on the outside and bigger on the inside. So Doctor Who's TARDIS is an example of that. You know, sort of, they're always the one was people, that's the first thing they say, oh, it's bigger on the inside when they walk in. Now, and some may appear to be almost infinite in size, but are just merely distortions of perception. And Christopher Priest's Inverted World is an example of that here. But the examples we'll be talking about today have boundaries, however big those boundaries are. Now, I mentioned Ringworld early on by Larry Niven, and that fits the definition perfectly for a megastructure. It's a massive rotating space wheel centered around a star, with a radius of approximately 300,000 kilometres, which is about one AU, which is one astronomical unit, which you and I, David, being astronomy fans, know is a standard measure for solar systems, and it's about the average distance from the Earth to the Sun, so about 300,000 kilometres. Now, Ringworld itself, the structure across, not the diameter, but across the actual ribbon of it, the ring of it, is about 1 million kilometres wide. This makes it a really big, big structure. It means it's approximately about 1 billion kilometres in circumference. That's a long way. And having about 1 billion square kilometres of surface area. So it's huge. But it's actually not the biggest thing that we're going to be discussing today. And in fact, we're actually going to pass on discussing Ringworld today. It's well known to a lot of people, as I said earlier, and it won a Hugo Award in 1970. So we'll be getting to that novel when we do the Hugo Time Machine for 1970. So it's not worthwhile it's not worth anybody's time just covering it now. We'll just mention it in passing and move on. Another one that we will also be discussing in the Hugo Awards, in fact, for the year after 1971, is Arthur C. Clarke's Rama, the spaceship, from his novel Rendezvous with Rama and its many sequels. Now, this object is a 50 by 20 kilometre cylindrical alien spaceship travelling between the stars at sub-light speed. It's big, but we're actually going to be talking about bigger spaceships than that in today's episode. And it was in the news a year or so back, I think, when that cigar-shaped object, whose name I can't remember, but is Hawaiian for traveller from afar, came through the solar system, and it was determined that that was the first one that had been positively identified as being a piece of space debris or large asteroid or ex-comet or comet itself that had passed through our solar system and have been identified as being from a another solar system somewhere in the galaxy. So it was brought up because it was long and cylindrical and cigar-shaped, and they actually did send radio signals to it just on the off chance, David, that there might have been somebody out there listening.
Don't forget, Perry, that they actually detected a slight acceleration as it went through the solar system.
Yes. That was a bit dodgy, I think. I think that might have been a little bit because there might have been a bit of venting of gas off one end of it somewhere. I I don't think it came out of an exhaust pipe somehow. But anyway, so we've spoken about a number of things that we're not going to be covering today, and that's okay, but really we should be talking about what it is we are going to be covering. So in no particular order, we'll be discussing things like city-sized spaceships, space elevators, spaceships constructed out of Jupiter-sized planets, Dyson spheres, and a whole lot of extra stuff. Now, all of them are very, very big by current standards, and that's what we're talking about, and that's what we mean by megastructures. So, David, do you want to start us off? What do you have for us today on the megastructure
theme? Okay, well, I'm going to start with, it's actually a series of books by James Blish. The series is called The Cities in Flight series. Now, before I start, I should point out that we're not going to be talking today so much about the quality of these novels, or you know, whether they're such a great read, but we're talking about the structures that they've described in them. That's what the key is today. Okay, so Cities in Flight by James Blish. This consists of four novels, three of which I think Perry and I have been calling fix-ups, books in which the author has brought together a number of originally separate short stories or novella, and sort of bung them together and sort of written linking things to make them into a coherent novel. So in the case of these books by James Blish, the pieces that make them up were mostly written in the 1950s. I think the first one was probably 1950, 1952, something like that. One of them was a bit later, which is called A Life for the Stars, and that's isn't a fix-up novel. It's a juvenile novel published in 1962. Now, this was my entree into this whole series of books. I must have read it not long after it came out, when I was about 11 or 12 or something like that, and I loved it. So it's a juvenile, and it's still the best introduction to the series, because it starts with this teenage boy, Chris DeFord, who's watching the city of Scranton, Pennsylvania, lift off into space. Now, before the city takes off, he gets press ganged as cheap labor and taken aboard, and then off they fly through space. They lift the whole damn city off the surface and fly it into space, and then they travel to other stellar systems looking for work. By the way, forget about the speed of light. That's just an error made in the 20th century in the physics there. We don't have to worry about the speed of light. Anyway, eventually young Chris is traded by Scranton with another city, the city of New York. So one of the major characters in the series is John Namalfi, who's the mayor of New York, who has his bridge, his control room, if you like, at the top of the Empire State Building, which is still in the novel anyway, the tallest building in the city and probably the tallest in the world. So what we're concentrating on today is this whole idea of the idea of whole cities traveling through space. So Blish comes up with the idea of these engines, which can manipulate gravity and do some other clever things, and he calls them spin dizzies. There's a nice summary on Wikipedia of that, so I thought I'd just simply quote it because it sums it up pretty well. So Wikipedia says, "The spin dizzy is an anti-gravity and faster-than-light flight device. The drive also produces a force field barrier around the city that keeps it in its atmosphere and heat. And one unusual aspect of the drive is that the larger the mass inside the spin dizzy field, the higher the velocity it can achieve." Now, all this is complete scientific nonsense, of course, but rereading it today, there are some interesting things in the series. In the novel, which is chronologically the first, which is called They Shall Have Stars, we get the background to the creation of this spin-dizzy technology. So in the early 21st century in the novel, they're actually building a bridge on Jupiter, constructed of an allotrope of ice, which is stronger than steel under the prevailing temperature and pressure there. It's kind of got a surface on Jupiter, which we don't think exists now, but never mind. In the 1950s, that's what they thought, there was some sort of surface on Jupiter. So they're trying to build this bridge remotely using remote robots and things that are controlling things. And they're doing it in order to test the theories about gravity. And eventually the results of that lead to the invention of the spin dizzy. But a lot of the novel is also really a critique of the McCarthy era in American politics, when anybody who had any sort of association with communism or socialism even was under suspicion and getting grilled in Congress. So it's interesting to read it today from that point of view, but it's also interesting that a lot of it applies to modern day politics. For example, we have a lot of politicians who are wanting to suppress any science which doesn't align with their own political views, and also to ignore any laws that they're finding convenient. I found a number of bits in there which I could just quote, which would be absolutely applicable today to the Trump administration. But so it's interesting from that point of view, but let's go on. So this is where we get struck into the megastructures in the novel Earthman Come Home, which again is one of those fix-up novels made up of bits and pieces. So it's a bit uneven because it's made up of these different bits and pieces. It sort of works, but you have these ups and downs of the plot and the tension in the plot. So you've got these whole cities, including the city of New York, traveling about looking for work in the galaxy. They sort of land on a planet and do some mining or whatever under contract, and then they take off again. And at one point, the mayor of New York, John Amalfi, actually uses spin disease to tip a whole planet on its axis to straighten it up. And that has the side effect of it racing off into space towards the lesser Magellanic Cloud. And later on, he uses another planet to plunge into the solar system and swat a huge spacecraft from the evil vegan empire. Splat! It's like swatting a fly. So it's all quite fun, but it's very hard to take any of it seriously. None of it's great literature, but you know, like a lot of science fiction, it was very appealing to me in my pre-teenage or early teenage years. It was a lot of fun.
I think I have read one of those somewhere or other, but I know the basic idea of it of the series, but wasn't anything that I picked up and followed through. But just goes to show you that you can, with a bit of imagination, you can sort of move anything through space, David. Anything at all. Now, the first book I want to talk about today is a book by Ian M. Banks. Now, you've got to remember the M in the author's name here. This is a signal that this is one of his science fiction novels. Ian Banks wrote a large number of non-science fiction novels and published those under the name Ian Banks, and his science fiction under the name Ian M. Banks, which he described as the most transparent pseudonym in history, which is probably right. I started to read this book because I wanted to read something about space elevators, and I'll get to that in a minute. Now, this book is set in and around the base station. Well, that's what I'd heard, it was set in and around the base station of a space elevator. Well, it is in part, but the problem is that we're in the far future, and that's station around the base of the elevator is now derelict and has been referred to as a castle, and the elevator is a tower of the castle. And there isn't much interaction with the elevator in at all in this novel until the very end of it, and the elevator hasn't been used for many years, and the secret of its purpose has been mainly lost. But I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here, David, and I think we really should define what I mean by a space elevator. Well, basically, it's an elevator to space. I know that sounds ridiculous, but that's really what it is. The bottom of it's anchored on a planet surface or a body surface. It doesn't have to be the Earth. Could be a moon, could be a planet, anything with a solid surface. You anchor the bottom of the space elevator there, especially near the equator. And then the cables from the anchoring point are strung up into space, or, if you like, from space down to the anchor, and they basically are counterweighted at the top end by a very large object, which is normally, most people consider it would be a relocated asteroid of enough weight to be able to hold the cables steady. Now, the whole idea of this is that the point at the top of the elevator where the elevators stop is around about the geostationary orbit for the body that you're dealing with. Now, to give you an idea of what that means, a geostationary orbit is, if you take it for the Earth, geostationary orbit for the Earth is that if you put an object like a satellite into that particular orbit, it will generally stay above one particular point on the Earth for its whole orbit. So it just basically follows the Earth's orbit around. For the Earth, because of its mass and its gravity, that's geostationary orbit is a touch under 35,800 kilometres above the surface. That's a long way. That's a lot of material to put into an elevator. A lot of cables. But the idea is that if you run the cables all the way right up in this elevator and you have the counterweight at the top holding all the cables to a level of tension, it means that you can run elevator carriages up and down this particular elevator, and you do it with a minimal power requirement. There's no rocket ships that you need. You just basically start pulling it up. And in fact, if you time things properly, you can get a lot of your power requirements from the fact that the gravitational attraction and potential energy of the elevator carriage coming down helps to raise the carriage going up. Now, I think it's the second law of thermodynamics. Isn't that the one that says you always lose? Basically it means you have to put power into it, but you don't even it out that the weight coming down and the power generated does not equal the power required to move the carriage up. You just got to put a little bit of power in, but the amount of power that you do have to include is fairly minimal. Now, this whole concept was first conceived back in 1895 by Russian scientist Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, who's generally regarded by many people as being one of the founders of modern rocketry and astronautics. And the concept was popularized by Arthur C. Clarke, again, in his 1979 novel, Fountains of Paradise. This is another novel that won the Hugo Award in 1979-1980, and it'll be covered in greater detail when we get down to that particular Hugo time machine. So I wasn't going to deal with that in a big way. But this is just an idea of giving you and introducing the concept of space elevators. Now, after Clarke wrote Fountains of Paradise, in which the anchor point was in Sri Lanka, which is where he was living at the time, it's also been taken up by other writers, including Kim Stanley Robinson in Red Mars, where he has a space elevator from the surface of Mars up to, I think it's one of the Mars moons, which in an anarchist act is actually blown up. So the whole thing falls down,
yep,
all the way across the surface of Mars, which is rather interesting. Charles Sheffield in The Web Between the Worlds, which came out pretty much the same time as Clark's. So he only just missed out. I think he missed out by about a year. And also Larry Niven in Rainbow Mars, which I haven't read, but I believe that it's there. There are many others. It's turned up in a lot of TV shows. It's probably in Star Trek and a fair few others. It's an interesting concept that needs a lot of engineering problems to be overcome before one can build it, not least the fact that you've got to get the elevator's building material right, and then also jockeying the required counterweight into the correct orbit. There's a lot of things that you need to learn how to do before one of these things could be constructed and brought into use. Unfortunately, I read Fearsome Engine with the idea that I'd been told that this was, as I said, set around a space elevator and that there would be something about the space elevator in the book. It's very, very minimal. It's there in the background, and you could almost be forgiven for the vast bulk of the time that you're reading the book that you wouldn't even know.
Mm.
So I was a bit misinformed by that one, unfortunately, but it was still an interesting read, and it's still an interesting concept. Which has been picked up and taken off by a number of writers in the field. Banks doesn't go into much explanation of it. I think by the mid-90s when he wrote this book, that the concept was already reasonably well known and that he just didn't need an explanation, really. So it wasn't the right book for this particular program, but happens.
That's all right. I remember the Kim Stanley Robinson one, which is in Red Mars, if I remember rightly. One of the interesting things about that was that he has this space elevator happening, but they have to arrange it so that it has a bit of a wobble in it. Do you remember? It has to have a wobble so that the moon Deimos can actually pass it by without cutting through it, because to reach the geostationary point, the orbit of Deimos is actually below that point, and so they actually have to have a kind of this constant wobble in the elevator cable, so that every time Deimos comes by, it doesn't go right through the cable, which is quite
funny. I had forgotten that part of things.
That's a lot of fun.
I think that was a lot of fun. I think he basically used that as an intellectual exercise to see what he can come up with. I think it would have been easier to shift the other moon to the right spot.
And of course, the nice thing is you mentioned that it gets that the whatever the anchor point is in space gets blown up, and the whole thing crashes down to the surface of Mars. But when you see how long this thing has got to be, it actually wraps around Mars a couple of times, I think, as it falls down. So it's a lot of good. It's a lot of interesting stuff.
Well, 35,800 kilometres is probably more than the circumference of the Earth. So if it blew up at the top end and disconnected from the top and came down, it would wrap itself around the whole of the Earth make a fair bit of mess.
Yes,
which would probably leave you to believe that there's very little chance of one of these things ever being built on the Earth. Maybe the Moon, or another body, but not the Earth.
Yeah, indeed. All right, so what have we got next? I am going to talk about a book which was written in 1985, and this is Eon, E-O-N, Eon by Greg Bear. Written in 1985, but the story opens in the year 2000 with the detection of a huge asteroid approaching the Earth. And this object, which gets nicknamed the Stone, is roughly cylinder-shaped. It's about 300 kilometres long, so it's pretty big. 300 kilometres long and 100 kilometres in diameter. Now, rather than hitting the Earth, however, which would be the start of a lot of disaster novels, instead of that, it falls into a stable orbit, looping around the Earth and the Moon. And it comes as close as 10,000 kilometres to the Earth, and at its furthest is about 500,000 kilometres away. Now, this stable, precise orbit can't possibly have come about naturally. And so, of course, the assumption is that it's been placed there by some sort of alien race or something. So everybody's very excited by it. So you have to remember that this was written in 1995, when the Soviet Union was still in existence. And so there's a lot of the story revolving around the bitter rivalry between the Russians and the Americans. In fact, by the year 2000 in the story, there's already been a limited nuclear exchange between the two nations, killing hundreds of thousands of people. And this short war was called the Little Death, and it led to an uneasy peace treaty between them for a while. Now, when the Stone arrives, the Americans manage to land on it first, and they begin investigating. And although they claim to be cooperating with international partners, including the Soviets, the Americans, because they were there first, have got the upper hand. And the Russians are really annoyed and deeply suspicious that they're not being told everything that the Americans are finding out about this thing. The Stone, the Americans discover, has been hollowed out into a number of internal chambers. It's rotating fast enough to simulate about 0.6 Earth's gravity through centrifugal acceleration. Now, it's a bit hard to visualize the scale here, so I did my best to try and describe it. If you were standing on the inner surface of one of these chambers, it would be like being in a deep valley about 30 or 40 kilometers wide. 25 kilometers above you is a glowing tube which lights up the space, and it runs along the rotational axis of the object, the Stone. And this valley would sort of curve upwards in front of you in the distance and behind you, of course, until it becomes hard to see overhead behind the glowing tube. Now, as they investigate, they sort of start at one end of this thing and move through one chamber to another as they progress in their explorations. There appear to be seven of these chambers. Each one of them is quite different in all sorts of ways. And the explorers don't find anybody on board this thing. There's no inhabitants. So one of these chambers includes an abandoned city, a park-like area with lakes and forests. One has a futuristic city, which is semi-functional, but it's also still empty. It's also empty like the others. But in the city, this more futuristic city, they discover libraries, which they find out how to operate, and that then reveals things to them. But the real revelation, though, is when the explorers from Earth, as they go from one chamber to another, penetrate to reach the seventh chamber. And when they pass through the far wall of the sixth chamber into the seventh chamber, they discover to their utter astonishment that the seventh chamber doesn't have another wall. Though it has the same 50 kilometer diameter as the other chambers, the surface just appears to go on forever, just this endless corridor. Perhaps it goes to infinity in this endless tube. Anyway, it eventually becomes clear, amazing though it is, that the stone is actually being created by human beings, but humans from the far future, our far future. And somehow the stone has travelled back through time to return to its point of creation. And now you sort of slowly get this, it's quite a big, thick book. The solution of all this takes some time to come about, but eventually it sort of makes some sort of sense as to what's occurred with these far future humans who've built this this thing and created this endless tunnel, which they call the Way. So ultimately, the people from Earth are contacted by these people who built the stone and built this thing called the Way, and they come from a place called Axis City, which has been traveling down this endless way. And it's currently a million kilometres down the track. So anyway, they contact the humans there, and there's lots of discussion. Now, I'm not going to talk about the plot of the story, which gets very complicated, really, particularly towards the end. There's a lot of discussion of the politics of Axis City and the way various factions have come about, some of whom want to go back to living very ordinary sort of lives, or very human sort of lives, and others who want to change human beings into something much much more advanced. And it's not a bad novel. There's some interesting characters, but as I say, towards the end, I found it became a bit tedious. And so the best part of the book is really the early parts, where the modern humans are discovering the structure of the stone and the discovery of the Way. So it's interesting. So here's our megastructure anyway. You've got this huge hollowed out asteroid and this essentially infinite tunnel they've created through space-time, which is a pretty interesting sort of structure. So there. Have you read this book, Perry?
No, I haven't, but I'm starting to hear some standard sort of plot structures occurring here, and some more of them will pop up in the next couple of things that we have to deal with as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth reading, I would say. Yeah. It didn't win the Hugo or anything, but it would have been a contender, I would have thought.
All right. Well, be one of those ones we'll probably get to sometime when I get a chance. If I can squeeze it in amongst all the others, David.
Indeed, indeed.
Next up for me is a novel featuring a giant spaceship. This is the novel Marrow, written by Robert Reed in the year 2000. And it was the first in his great ship series of novels and shorter fiction. So far, there's been about 7 novels and 25 or so shorter pieces. It's building into a big series, probably fitting given the subject matter. Reed's one of these guys that I came across in the last few years because he's been popping up in some of the best of the year anthologies or collections that I've been reading. I hadn't come across him previously, but he's probably a couple of years younger than me. So he's born in about the late 50s. So he's been writing for, 30-odd years or so. And this just goes to show you there's a whole lot of people out there that I've just never heard of.
Yeah.
And so that's one good thing about this particular podcast, David, is that it's starting to introduce me to people that I didn't know about terribly much anymore,
indeed.
Previously, which is always a good thing.
It is.
Anyway, to the novel in question here, Marrow. So sometime in the early, far distant universe, the great ship was built by a race of unknown aliens and sent on its way. In our distant future, humanity has become a spacefaring, technologically advanced race of immortals, in all intents and purposes, who discover the ship as it enters the neighbourhood of the Milky Way. And the ship's travelling at about a quarter light speed, so it's a big ship travelling fairly quickly. Now, the humans get to it first. I mean, get to it. They're the first ones from the Milky Way galaxy to get to the ship and explore it. And they sort of basically take it over and close it off to everybody else. Or everybody else, I mean, other alien races that attempt to board it. And after they do a lot of exploration of the ship, which we don't spend too much time with, which is good because it's a bloody big ship and it would take a lot of the book if that's what they were going to talk about, the humans who take it over decide that they're going to turn it into a gigantic cruise ship. and put it on a cruise circumnavigating the galaxy in a million-year-long voyage. And so they send a note out to, they send communications out to other races in the galaxy that they are aware of, inviting them to join the humans on board this particular ship.
I hope it has good infection control.
Well, yeah, so do I. And so a whole lot of them turn up and basically keep on arriving. Some leave, some come on and have a look at it. They don't like it and then leave. And that's it. Off she runs. Now, about 100,000 years later, and the people that first got to the ship are still there, so that's what I mean by they're immortal.
Okay.
100,000 years later, a chance discovery at the heart of the ship, a subsequent mutiny, and then war threatens to destroy the entire vessel. That's really, I'm not going to go deeply into the plot. It's too long and too big. It's a slow-moving novel that attempts to cover far too much time and territory in its 500 or so pages. But I guess you'll understand why when I go into a bit more detail about this particular ship and how it is. As I said, they don't know. The people that explore it slowly start to determine some of the origins of the ship. And it seems to be that it weighs about 20 Earth masses all up. And it appears to be constructed from the bones of a Jovian-sized planet. So the planet Jupiter, theoretically, it's considered to have basically a rocky or molten metal sized core about the size of the Earth, give or take, somewhere around about that size. Maybe Mars, maybe Earth, doesn't matter, something big enough. And then the rest of the planet is basically gas. So what this alien race has done is taken one of these gas giants, kept the core, stripped the atmosphere off and broken it down into its constituent parts, and is going to use that for fuel, because mostly it's hydrogen and oxygen and water and all the rest of it. They've taken it all apart and used whatever they need. And they've built a giant structure around the core of this thing so that the final result looks like a Jupiter-sized planet, but it's a ship. And this thing's ploughing through the galaxy at a quarter of the speed of light, so it doesn't have to hit things very big and it's going to make a bit of a mess. But, of course, that's all solved by the fact, it's actually not really solved. It's a bit, there's a fair bit of hand-wavy stuff in this particular book the author basically doesn't really cover and look at terribly well. So they've got the core of the ship, which is the marrow. So it's a Earth-sized planet, which is very volcanically active, by the way. Which sort of raises the question of what are they doing with the excess heat here? Where's that going? Doesn't seem to be any anything in the novel to take care of that. There's a bit of a problem about gravity. Now, I'm not a gravitational scientist, David, so I really don't know. If you were living on this structure, would the gravity at the outside hull edge be the same as it would be in the centre? I don't know. But it wouldn't be.
Well, no.
It wouldn't be the same.
No.
It wouldn't be the same.
It'd be less.
It'd be less. So basically, what you end up with is the same gravity all the way through this ship, with no explanation as to how that happens. So that's a bit of a problem. At the height of, to give you an idea, right? So we said that the ship's about the size of Jupiter. It has rocket motors that are about the size of small moons.
Right.
And at its height, say 50,000 years after the human discovery, the great ship houses thousands of alien races and around 200 billion inhabitants. There's a lot of individuals on this particular thing. And whole alien races can live in these large, great open spaces or fuel tanks. And some of them do. There's some of them that actually live in the liquid hydrogen fuel tanks. Don't know why, but they do. So it's a big ship, a really big ship, which is why it's called the Great Ship, because I can't think of anything else to call it. There's some problems here that with the science of it, which I think the author basically gets into the problem of trying to give enough information but not too much, and in doing so he gets halfway through to describe what's going on. I've read some of the shorter fiction that it's based on this, and they are much better because it just tells a story around the great ship and about aliens coming on and aliens leaving and the interactions between them. It doesn't go into the problem of the propulsion ships, the gravity and all the rest of it. And it seems to be that they have a tendency to show up a bit more in this novel rather than in the shorter level stuff. But look, it's certainly big.
Yes, it's certainly big. Qualifies.
I think it would have been better if a lot of it was a bit more unexplainable and just not got into it, but it really gives you a sense of that old sense of wonder stuff. It's, yeah, you know, big. Now, I don't know whether I'll read any more of the novels in this particular series. As I said, the shorter fiction that I've read, written by Reed about the great ship, is probably more to my liking, and I'll probably read those as I come across them. But if you're looking for big, old-fashioned style, sense of wonder, science fiction with a really gigantic, unexplainable, alien-built spaceship, this is the book for you.
That sounds good. Now, when you say it's called marrow, is this because it's like a huge vegetable marrow? Is that what
No. Marrow, as in the bones of the or the stuff within the bones.
Okay.
So the very core of the planet, the planet that's in the middle, the Earth or Mars sized planet that's volcanically active here, right in the middle, is called marrow because it's the thing that sort of is the absolute middle of the core.
Okay, well, that's good, because every time I hear the word, I keep visioning one of these gigantic pumpkins or gigantic marrows that people grow. No, okay, fine.
That's actually a good point. Maybe you should have written a book about a gigantic marrow flying through space.
Terry Pratchett would have done it well.
Or Douglas Adams might have gone to that one. But anyway, it certainly fits that big style, mega structure stuff. And it's interesting.
Okay, all right. My next one I'm going to talk about is, again, a couple of books rather than just one book. It's a series by Edgar Rice Burroughs called the Pellucidar series. We mentioned Savage Pellucidar in the last episode, which was one of the last bits of fiction that Edgar Rice Burroughs wrote, and we agreed it's terrible. But these two books, which were published in 1914 and 1915, so much earlier than Savage Pellucidar, where he started with this whole idea, and they're at least readable, I think. I mean, they're full of the same kind of adventure stuff that you get in his Barsoom series set on Mars, you know, John Carter of Mars, Princess of Mars, that sort of thing. Or for that matter, his Tarzan books. Reasonably well done for the most part, but certainly not great literature. Good stuff to read when you're 12 years old, I think. So the characters are stereotypes and they're wooden, and the interactions between men and women are embarrassingly bad and stagey. So the interest from our point of view for today's podcast is this setting of the novels in this place called Pellucidar. And it's a place inside the inner surface of the Earth, which the protagonist discovers hollow. So let me just summarize the start of At the Earth's Core as the best way to introduce the idea and how Burroughs gets us into the concept. So the protagonist is a young man called David Innes. His father was a wealthy mine owner, and to fulfill his father's dying wish, David Innes is undertaking kind of a 2 years apprenticeship to learn the business, the mining business, at a grassroots level. Perhaps I should say at the coalface or something like that. Anyway, he's doing some basic work to learn the thing. And during that time, he's approached by an old guy called Abner Perry. Perry has spent a long time perfecting a device he calls a mechanical subterranean prospector. It's basically a burrowing vessel. It's intended to burrow down underground and allow the operator to hunt around looking for veins of ore. So Innes looks at this working model and advances some money so that Perry can complete it. So eventually Perry asks, he's got it all ready, and asks him if David wants to be aboard during the first trial. And he agrees, of course, and they climb in and power it up. Alas, the engine is far more powerful than they expected, and it starts to plunge down rapidly, burrowing as it goes. So they're moving downward so fast that it's impossible to turn the vessel back to the horizontal, which was the original plan, to sort of burrow down and then go horizontally. So they keep burrowing down and down and down vertically, with the temperature getting higher and higher. So they're already far underground when they stop the engine, but they realise that they're eventually going to run out of air, and they can't just reverse this thing to go up. So they start the engine again because there's no other choice. They're hoping to sort of bend it back to a bit more of a level and maybe come up eventually. And after a long while, to their great surprise, the temperature starts to stabilize and then goes down again. So maybe they are reapproaching the surface after all. And suddenly they emerge into the sunlight and they're convinced for a while that they're back. And perhaps they've emerged somewhere in South America or something like that. And then finally they realize the truth. They've passed right through the 500-mile thick shell of a hollow Earth and are now inside. And the gravitational attraction of the rocky material of the shell means that they're pulled down to it. And so the down is now away from the Earth's center. And up above them is this bright glowing ball, an interior sun, which lights up the place. So Burroughs populates this land with primitive humans, intelligent gorillas, and a race of even more intelligent pterosaurs called Mesops, who are the rulers of the place. And pretty soon, Innes and Perry are captured by the gorillas and they're forced to march towards slavery. They're going to be slaves under the Mesops, along with many other humans. And while he's in this group marching along, Innes meets up with them finally and quickly falls for a young woman whose name is Deanne the Beautiful. Just so that we don't have any doubts about whether she's good looking or not. So I'm not going to summarise the plot any further, but I've just mentioned that if you are interested, both of these books, At the Earth's Core and the sequel, Pellucidar, are now in the public domain, and you can get them in a nicely formatted free ebook from standardebooks.org. Now, Burroughs has got a nonsensical justification for how the Earth, and indeed, according to him, all the rocky planets are formed in this way with the hollow core, but it's barely worth going into. It's so nonsensical. I mean, there's so much wrong with all the science here that's not funny. For a start, as far back as Isaac Newton, Newton showed that inside such a hollow sphere, gravity would cancel out and you'd be floating around inside. Never mind. But there are some interesting aspects to Pellucidar, and Burroughs actually does a pretty good job, I think, visualising the place. For a start, you look out into the distance and there's no horizon. You look out and the land can be seen to start to curve upwards before it vanishes into the haze of distance. There's no night, no day, because the interior sun is always there. And this messes up with people's sense of the duration of time. Indeed, Edgar Rice Burroughs seems to suggest that time flows at varying rate for different people inside Pellucidar. So there's a vast surface area which is only a little less than that of the outer Earth. And even perhaps a bit more, because there's more land to see in Pellucidar than in our world. Anyway, it's all of this, I think, is an interesting precursor to the idea of a Dyson sphere, which is an artificially constructed hollow world, as I think Perry's going to talk about very shortly. But I went back and did a bit of research, and the idea of a hollow Earth isn't original to Burroughs. I don't know whether you're familiar with this book, Perry. It's called Fads and Fallacies in the Name of Science by Martin Gardner, published initially in 1952.
This is the Martin Gardner that used to write for Scientific American?
Indeed, yep, right. Absolutely.
Okay.
And it's a really interesting read, but it's a bit dated now, but because some of the controversies and fads and fallacies are a bit now, you know, sort of fallen by the wayside. But he talks about the Flat Earth Society and a whole lot of other things, which was a very entertaining read. Anyway, among all these other weird ideas, he discusses the history of the concept of a hollow Earth. It was first floated by someone called Captain John Cleves Sims in the early 1800s. However, Sims's Earth had many interior concentric shells, whereas in 1913, someone called Marshall B. Gardner, which is a bit similar to the name of the author of this book, came up but with a purely hollow Earth, which seems to be the absolute model that Edgar Rice Burroughs borrowed for At the Earth's Core. So it's a lot of fun, but very hard to take any of it seriously.
Well, as you say, it does sound like a Dyson sphere, which is in the next book that I'm going to be talking about. So that was one of the naturally occurring megastructures that we referred to right at the very beginning of the episode. And David has given me a bit of a lead-in, and as you will also recall, we mentioned Ringworld as a major megastructure, which it is, but it's certainly not the largest one. The one that we're about to talk about now is probably. Now, the Ringworld can be described as sort of a Dyson ribbon or a Dyson strip, so it's like a ribbon of material that runs all the way right around a star at around about Earth's orbit. Now, if you visualise that and then enclose the whole of the orbit all the way right around in a gigantic sphere, you have what's known as a Dyson sphere. Now, this particular construct was vaguely described by Olaf Stapleton in his novel Starmaker in 1937, but the concept was really formalised a lot more in 1960 by the late physicist Freeman Dyson. He only died in the last 12 months, I think.
Yeah, I think it's about right.
12 months or so. Now, he explained that his view was that a technologically advanced race would progress to the point where its energy requirements would be such that, and energy in space requirements would be such that it would require the whole of the power output of a star for it to maintain its technology, and also it would need the whole of the inside of a sphere to be able to house all of its people. Well, yeah, that's a hell of a lot of people, though, as we'll find out. So, actually, Dyson spheres have been in the news in the last couple of years, or the astronomy news in the last couple of years, David, with discussions around something called Tabby's star.
Oh, yes.
You may have probably heard of this. This is a star that's been observed to have lost around 22% of its brightness over a fairly short period. And there have been a number of explanations for it, for why that has happened. And one of those possible explanations was that this was the site of an ongoing Dyson sphere construction. Now, as we know, David, that normally when you come up with an idea that aliens did it, that isn't the explanation.
It's usually wrong. Always wrong.
That's always wrong. This has now been pretty much disproved, and there's a theory going around that it's actually a planet that's or a couple of moons that have just been disintegrated under the gravitational attraction of either the sun or a large planet. Now, there's nothing to terribly worry about with this because Tabby star is an F3 type star, about 1,500 light years from Earth. And we'll probably get to... we'll have a bit of a quick chat about star types, David. Mm-hmm. You're aware of the classification of stars into their different types?
I'm aware of it.
BAF... Do you know the acronym?
No, I don't.
Ah, right. If you want to know what the structures... So each of the different types of stars in the universe on the main sequence, which these are the standard sort of stars, has a letter and then a number to describe the type so that you can instantly tell what type a star is. Now, they start off with the really bright ones, bright blue ones, and go all the way right down to the little red dwarfs down the bottom. The little saying that you do use to remember them is, "Oh, be a fine girl, kiss me." So the classification classes are O, B, A, F, G, K, and M. Now, in each of those classifications, there are 10 different levels, 0 through to 9. Our sun is considered to be a sort of a G3.
Yep.
Tabby star is an F3, so it's one level up in terms of the classification, similar sort of level inside that next level up. So probably another 10% brighter and 20 or 30% bigger or something along those lines. I'm not entirely sure exactly what the differences are, but it basically tells you that it's brighter anyway. Now, putting that aside, we'll get back to what we wanted to be talking about. And that's my novel under discussion here is Orbitsville by Bob Shaw, written in the mid-70s, 74, I think. Now, this concerns the discovery and colonisation of just such a Dyson sphere. This basically tells the story of one starship captain who's got into a bit of trouble back on Earth, and he's fleeing Earth to escape persecution by the Empress. He's allowed the Empress's son to die in his care, and he realises that the Empress is going to basically kill him, his family, and everybody he's ever met as a retribution, so he decides he's going to get out and leave. Luckily enough, he's a starship captain. Now, this is sometime in the future. At some point, where it gets all nice hand-wavy, as we always get in this point in these novels, scientists on Earth have discovered that if you get past about 20% of the speed of light, things change in the universe so that the only constant after that level is time and not the speed of light. So in other words, you could actually go much, much faster than the speed of than the speed of light, as long as you conserve your time. That was a bit hand-wavy, and I didn't really quite get it. But anyway, what has happened is that Earth's slowly coming apart. It's overcrowded. The powers that be have decided that what they're going to do is move a lot of people off the Earth and try to put them out onto different planets. But they've only ever found one other. That's called Terra Nova. Now, there's been a lot of exploration of a whole lot of planets within 1,000 or so light years of the Earth, but nothing else has ever been found, except for one particular planet where there had been an alien race on it which had killed itself or gone extinct, and they found some documentation which showed that there was one particular star in the nearby vicinity which was there on some star charts and not there on others. There's been this theory that it just disappeared and I don't know, who knows what happened. So this rogue captain decides that that's the place he's going to go because he doesn't think that the Empress will follow him and try and find him there. And lo and behold, he finds out that, yes, there is something there, only you can't see it. It's only emitting in the infrared because it's a Dyson sphere. Mm-hmm. So this is a star that is completely surrounded by a full sphere of material. He finds the one and only entrance, he goes in, and lo and behold, there it is. It's classically, the gravity's about right, the sunlight, the atmosphere's about right, everything's perfect. It just looks like Eden and perfection. And so basically the rest of the novel is just one crisis after another as these things go, resulting in the fact that he's ended up on one side of the of this inside of the Dyson sphere, and he has to get all the way back around to the other side again, which is a hell of a long way, because it's if you can't fly across a spaceship and you have to come around the edge, you're basically talking about having to go, I don't know, 500 million kilometres. Hmm. That's sort of a bit further than down the end of the street. So it's going to take him a fair while. And so a lot of the novel deals with that sort of exploration that's basically going on. And people that know Ringworld will know that the plot's fairly reminiscent of that. So really what we've got here is a very large structure. The interior surface area of this particular sphere is 625 million times the surface area of the Earth. It's ginormous. Basically, I don't know, I'm not going to do the numbers, but you pretty much basically get, you know, a tenth the size of the Earth all to yourself, David. That's not bad. They basically decide that they're going to shovel all the humans on there as fast as they possibly can because there's so much space, and we'll just let them get on with it. So the only thing about this novel is, well, look, it's okay. It won a BSFA award in 1975 as the best novel published in the UK in that year. The problem that any author has with a concept this big is that that tends to dominate. So you've either got the choice of almost ignoring it, like Banks does at the beginning, or having it being the only thing that's of any interest in the whole thing, as happens in Orbitsville. Your difficulty is you end up with cliched plots because it's just an exploration, really. And what you get here is a reasonable adventure novel, but nothing terribly startling. It's a good, quiet, fun route, good stuff. That's about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem with all these books with these mega structures in, really, is to try and tell an interesting story. You've got this vast amount of space or a vast amount of area, but to tell any sort of interesting story, it's really very difficult to make use of that size of the object, I think. And so you end up really with things like Orbitsville and Ringworld, where you've just got this... there's a word for it which I've forgotten, but it's a road novel. You're on the road, you're traveling from one point to another. It takes a heck of a long time because it's so big, and incidents happen to you along the way. That's really the only plots that kind of work. There's another one which is similar, which is Jack Vance's Big Planet, which is just a great big planet with a big surface area, but it's the same deal. You end up with just this story of traveling along through this sort of space. If we were thinking about what other objects in science fiction fit into this category, what do we want to talk about? One of the ones I had in mind was whether this fits the category or not, I'm not sure, which is The River World, which is out of Philip Jose Farmer's series of books, starting with To Your Scattered Bodies Go, which won the Hugo in 1971. So I won't talk too much about it because, again, we'll discuss it in the Hugo Time Machine.
Good title.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Well, it's a quote from John Donne. Are you familiar with the quote? At the round earth's imagined corners, blow your trumpets, angels, and arise, arise, you numberless infinities of dead, and to your scattered bodies go. Lovely stuff. And we talked about poetry, didn't we, the other day? So that's a nice quote. But it starts, I'm not going to talk about the plot at all, but just briefly in the in Wikipedia's description of the size of this thing, it's great. It's a super Earth planet, so it's bigger than the surface of the Earth. And it's been terraformed by some race we don't discover for quite a long time, which to consist solely of this long river valley that snakes across the entire surface and then loops back up to the top again. It's just this endless river valley. And the river has an average depth of 1.5 miles or 2.5 kilometres. And its width ranges from 6.8 miles to 25 miles. So it's shallow near the shore but plunges down to deep, very enormous depths. And on this world, of course, the basic story is that people who have died on Earth are resurrected on this planet and all mixed together from different eras and so on, which is certainly an interesting concept. So that's one. Maybe is that a megastructure? It kind of is, because you've got this huge planet which has been structured in this particular way to create this sort of thing.
Do we ever find out if it was constructed?
Yeah, we do. You've got to read the fourth or fifth book in the series about who set this up.
I didn't get that far.
Yeah, I didn't get that far. I ran out at about book three, but I looked.
Oh, you did better than I did. I read the first one, which I thought was all right.
The second one's kind of all right, but then it goes downhill rapidly.
Yeah, you come up with a good idea, use up all the good bits of the first novel, and then think, oh God, now what do I do? Well, Niven's done a couple of other big megastructures. We've talked about Ringworld. I was going to talk about the couple of novels that he's written with Greg Benford called the Shipstar series, which is basically he's constructed a ginormous spaceship, which uses as the heart of its engine as a star in the middle of it. And the rest of the ship is basically a big cup around the trailing end of the star. And they utilise, somehow or other, they're able to confine the solar wind coming out of the star into a particular tube that sort of, or a funnel that basically runs out through and moves the whole of the system, including the ship that's all the way right around the outside of the star through space. I read the first in the series, but I haven't actually, A Bowl of Heaven, I think it was called, but I haven't actually gone back to read the second, and I think there might even be a third one in that one. But that's an interesting interesting concept of using a star as the engine for a ship. And I think you've got something along the same lines, don't you?
Well, that's right. The thing I would ask about something like that, where you're using the star to travel along, is where are you going with this thing? What's the point if you're traveling anywhere? You know, you're already in a vast environment. You know, what need do you have to travel anywhere else? But anyway, I suppose a similar one is the Fleet of Worlds, which is the puppeteer system, where they've actually got I think it's 7 or 8 planets, which are all sort of orbiting each other. They're in what's called a Klemperer rosette. There's no sort of central sun which is holding them together. They're holding themselves together by the mutual attraction of these bodies, and that's quite nifty. And in fact, there's someone collaborated with Larry Niven called Edward M. Lerner, and there's a whole series of books called, starting with Fleet of Worlds, which take the whole story that Niven has set up in his Known Space series and elaborates it and in some ways contradicts it or shows you what was really happening when you thought you were reading about these things. And they're actually very well done, I thought, and they're well worthwhile. So I say the first one of those is called Fleet of Worlds, and that's Larry Niven and Edward M. Lerner.
Well, the reason behind why the Fleet of Worlds exists and why the puppeteers have engineered the Fleet of Worlds and why they're moving out leads directly into why the puppeteers are actually going out to have a look at Ringworld.
Yes.
Because that's why Lewis Wu and, was it Nisus, the puppeteer, and a few others go to Ringworld to actually explore it, to find out what it is, because the puppeteers have discovered it and they have never come across it before, and they're very interested in finding out why. The reason why the puppeteers are moving their planets away from the galaxy is that they've discovered that the centre of the galaxy is undergoing a massive runaway explosion and is going to wipe out the whole of the galaxy before long, and they just want to get moving as quickly as they can. But they don't like travelling faster than light, so I think they're only just going to barely stay ahead of the bow wave somehow. But he's done a few things like that in big ways. So that's, you know, sort of three big things that we've talked about that Niven's done. So he's
the master of megastructure, yes.
He is. Now, I spoke earlier about Ian Banks's novel Fearsome Engine. The major big thing that I didn't mention there, because I didn't want to go into it too much, is the engine of the title, which is an engine that's been built to actually move the Earth away from Earth, and Earth, I think it's just the Earth, to move the Earth away from the Sun, because there's this large cloud of destructive material coming towards the Sun, which is going to wipe it out and therefore destroy all life on Earth. So the fearsome engine is turned on at the end to actually move the planet further away. So a bit like the puppeteers here, trying to move something the size of a large planet away. Banks also deals with his culture novels with things that he calls orbitals, which he doesn't go into it. Well, I haven't gone into a lot of description about, but they are certainly analogous to Niven's Ringworlds. And he also has his big AI mind ships, his artificial intelligence. His big ships are full of artificial intelligence, which is another reason why we can't call them big dumb objects.
Big smart objects.
big smart objects, because he's got one particular novel, which we may be talking about later this year, that deals purely and simply, the only major characters in it are the AI minds in running these ships. So he was quite innovative as well. And it's interesting to hear that, or to read in the field these days and see so many of these big ships having artificial intelligences at the base and core of their beings. And you see it all over the place now.
And Leckie's books.
And Leckie's, although I heard the other day, you know, we were talking a while back about how we thought that Anne Leckie must have read Ian Banks, and she said she didn't. Hmm. I've since found out that she's a very big fan of C.J. Cherry's. Okay. And has probably picked up a fair bit of her stuff from there and expanded on it and just ended up almost in the same spot that Banks was.
That's
so interesting. I'm certainly willing to give Anne Leckie credence for her saying that she never read him, and that's fine, maybe she didn't. So just the way of it. So you just get through to the end, and hopefully she's gone back and read him later and sort of thought, oh, he's pretty good.
Yeah, it's certainly quite feasible that people come up with similar ideas without having read each other's work, and that happens. There's often a sort of zeitgeist around that, you know, some sort of ideas get floated and various authors pick up at them at the same time. So I don't think we don't need to accuse anybody of plagiarism. So.
No, not at all. And it's a conversation more than anything else as well, way I look at it is.
Yeah.
I mentioned earlier about Arthur C. Clarke and Charles Sheffield writing novels about space elevators. And they would have been writing them completely separately, unknown that each of the other was writing them. And it just so happened that Clark got in first and published his and won a Hugo for it. And then Sheffield came in later. Now, I haven't read Sheffield's book. I don't know whether he would have won a Hugo Award for his novel. But it's just interesting that two of them came out within a year of each other.
Yeah.
Sheffield could not have written it in the time after hearing about what Clark was doing. I wouldn't have thought.
No.
But anyway, that's interesting. Yep. So hopefully that's given people a bit of an idea about different types of megastructures floating around in science fiction from, well, earlier part of the 20th century right up until current times, really.
Indeed.
It's still a big... Here we go. I keep using the word big here, big, which I shouldn't, because it's not a pun.
Bigly.
It's basically a bigly. It's just a it's a well-used theme, and I think there's a lot more that can be done to explore megastructures of various sorts. We will see more coming up in the future, without a doubt.
Indeed, indeed. All right.
So I think that's about it for this time, David. I think we won't go into too much more.
Covered a fair bit of ground, yeah.
So would you like to tell the listener about next episode?
That's a good question. We're going to talk about some films, aren't we, but which are based on science fiction books from from the Eastern Bloc, I suppose you would say, wouldn't you?
Yes, you would. The Eastern Bloc as it was then, that's for sure.
It was as it was then, that's right. So we're going to talk about two films based on Stanislav Lem's Solaris, and we're going to talk about a film based on a book by the Strugatsky brothers. Is that how you pronounce it? Strugatsky brothers?
Strugatsky's, yeah.
Yeah, and which I think it's Roadside Picnic, isn't it?
Roadside Picnic's the novel, and Stalker is the film.
Yep, looking forward to that.
Yep. All right, David, thanks very much. We shall see you and the listener in 2 weeks' time.
Indeed, indeed.
Thanks very much. See you then.